Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
Welcome back to listeners. So, Doc, if you remember a few weeks ago, I was just having a terrible week. And so I posed a question on Facebook because there was just a lot going on in the news. And I posed a question on Facebook. I said, you know how when people in the NFL die, they'll donate their brains to science?
You know,
and they'll kind of like cut open their brains and figure out the ways in which concussions might affect, you know, if a guy's abusive or like if he has a drug, like to what degree does playing sports, does having a concussion affect your brain? And I pose the question, like, yes. I wonder if I die, can I donate my brain to science to figure out if racialized trauma is a real thing, right? The ways in which, like, either number one, experiencing racism myself, or vicarious racism through other people, or being an activist, or watching things on the news, like trauma porn, to what degree is this stuff really affecting me, right? Can I feel it when I have to stay on the couch all day and have a self-care day, or, you know, when times get emotional? So I was like, can I donate my brain to science and figure out if racialized trauma is a real thing?
Yes.
And so we decided to invite a psychologist to help us make sense of what exactly racialized trauma is and does it really affect Black people. So listeners, please welcome to the show Dr. Carlton Green. Dr. Green, how are you?
I'm well. How are y'all today?
Wonderful. So you're a counseling psychologist, and you specialize in what you consider culturally responsive therapy and racial trauma. Yeah. Tell our listeners, what exactly do we mean when we say, number one, that therapy should be culturally responsive, and number two, what is racial trauma, and is that a real thing?
Sure. So when we talk about conducting racially or culturally responsive trauma or therapy, what we really want to be thinking about is responding to the specific and unique needs of the individual person that is sitting in front of us. Not only does that mean responding to sort of like anxiety symptoms or depressive symptoms, but really having an understanding about who the person is and what referent groups they might be a part of. So like their racial group or their gendered group or their sexual orientation group. Because what we know is that being a part of those groups also has some psychology that comes along with it. There are thoughts, feelings, behaviors, ways of being in the world that are culturally grounded. So not only paying attention to the unique person, but what that person's connections are in the world. When we think about racial trauma, what we're really talking about are the physical and psychological reactions that people of color in particular have to being exposed to racist events, whether or not those racist events are events that occur in their daily lives. But also when we are, as Jay was referring to earlier, when we expose ourselves to this trauma porn, when we see the repeated, when we repeatedly view the killings of unarmed Black people, or when we are living in communities where we are being exposed to race-related death, or sort of like environmental racism that really taunts us or creates distress in our lives, the cumulative effect of knowing that that is happening daily in and out really can create a change in the way that our bodies experience and process the world. And so racial trauma, we're really talking about sort of like the stress that our bodies go through, as well as how our bodies begin to change, even right down to the genetic level when we're talking about being exposed to racism.
What are some of the ways in which that can manifest? Because obviously we think about the emotional ways that, you know, it makes me sad, it makes me cry, it makes me angry to see these things on television. But are there physical manifestations that can happen when you experience, you know, in this case, racialized trauma, or probably for people who are trans or LGBT, you know, that kind of trauma as well? How can it physically manifest?
Yeah, because what would be the symptoms? How would one know that one is experiencing racial trauma or trauma due to homophobia or transphobia?
Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about trauma, of course, the American Psychiatric Association, through the DSM, which is sort of like our diagnostic Bible, they've identified these four key areas that we think about with regards to symptoms. You can think about things like intrusion. You have memories. You have dreams that are sort of like being activated at the thought of being in a place where trauma occurred. Like if you were to be thinking about walking downtown in Dallas, right, where a few years ago those police officers were murdered after we had seen what had happened in Baton Rouge and Minneapolis. And so you're just there and you could be really activated. So having those types of things occur in your mind, right, or in your brain. There could be avoidance. You want to stay away from anything that would remind you of the trauma. There could be what we call negative cognitions, where there's sort of like a change in the way that your mind is actually processing the world. You could begin to have poor memory. You could have difficulty focusing or concentrating. There's a possibility that your self-concept takes a real dive. And I think that's specifically for socially marginalized groups. We begin to think of ourselves as worthless. We begin to detach emotionally from the world and may not even be able to experience positive emotions. There's also this sense of being hyper-aroused, right? So you're irritable all the time, which I find is probably one of the key pieces in the work that I do with clients. When I talk to them, they are having difficulty maintaining their relationships because they're just so irritable, and they become snappish with other people. The other piece that I think becomes really important with people of color is especially men. We become reckless in our behaviors. We engage in more high-risk behaviors because we're so agitated, we're angry, we're feeling helpless. Men begin to become reckless, whether or not that's like engaging in reckless sexual behavior, or we go out and we become engage in criminal activity some type of way. We just kind of lose any sense of valuing our own lives. Not only those, but you could also have stomach disturbance, or you could have sleep disturbance, just inability to concentrate. You could actually have an exaggerated startle response from being hypervigilant. So those are some of the types of symptoms that we see. I would also highlight from the work that I do with clients that when I'm talking to people, people will often dissociate. They will sort of like stare off and not even remember what we were talking about because it's so difficult for them to be with the experiences that they have to take a break from it. And the brain will actually do that for you. It'll just drift off. And so a lot of the things that I described may happen in your body, but they could also happen in your relationships when you're with other people.
Mm. Now, is this specialty or specialization growing in the field of psychology and therapy practices? Is it relatively new? And how have other therapists or psychologists responded to cultural responsive therapy and or racial trauma therapy? Like, how is it seen within your field? Are people picking up on this, even if they might not be from a marginalized group? They might not be an African-American or person of color, or they might not be LGBT.
Right. So that's a great question. In the field of psychology, if we think about psychology as with any other professional or academic discipline, has a history of being white. Mm. White folks generally don't have proficiency at being able to talk about race or identify when race is a component of an interaction or a part of any type of mental health issue. Because of that, historically, white folks haven't talked about this in their training or in their therapy, right? And the other thing that we know, not only are they not socialized to talk about it, but they are socialized to avoid talking about it, right? I work with folks who, or historically have worked with people who will put on a nice smile, or they will go silent, or they will just go blank in the face when the topic of race comes up. And we're talking about people who are actually gifted and really insightful and intelligent around other issues, but the moment race drops into the conversation, they just lose it, right? Mm-hmm. So because of that, historically, institutions of higher education, the discipline of psychology in particular, have not really done a good job of training mental health professionals to be able to talk about or assess and diagnose when race is a key component within a person's life, right? So because of that, what we see is there has been a move within the past 30 years or so through the American Psychological Association. And even I would say, as a counseling psychologist, we have really been at the forefront of trying to push mental health training to be inclusive of race and racism and race-related issues. But we're still a predominantly white female organization or discipline. And because of that, one of the things that I talk about when I go out and do trainings, white women, in my opinion, are highly invested in what I call the culture of nice. Mm. And if you're invested in being nice to each other, we know inherently talking about race is challenging. It's emotionally upsetting for people. And if they're invested in being nice, they're not going to let the conversation
being real, yes. Mm. Do you remember the TV show Real World that had an open, like, when people stop being polite and start being real?
Yes.
Like, right. You got to put aside this desire to be nice and polite and really get down to the nitty gritty.
Plus, I think it's fake and phony. I think that it's a socialized thing that is connected to whiteness and performances of femininity. And I see it as weaponized friendliness. I see it as disingenuous and fake and phony, because that kind of, turns into fierce antagonism,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And it is also a way to cover up mediocrity, I think in their fields as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure. The other thing that I would say about that, and what I found miraculously, when I go out and talk to mostly white female clinicians or white people in academic settings, when I bring this up, I'm usually a little bit anxious about talking about this in these white settings, because you know the narrative can flip real fast with a tall black man talking to you about some racial issue, and all of a sudden I'm the demon in the room, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. However, what I found is when I go out and I name this dynamic among white women, many of them are relieved because, you know what, they say, we do this, right? Yeah. And so I press it and let them know that your white niceness is actually killing us. It is putting my life at risk, because if you can have a real conversation with me about what it is that's affecting my mental or physical health, you're not doing your job. Your white niceness is killing us.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Dr. Green, I wonder, is there a right or wrong way to react to things we see? So we think about the deaths of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Ayanna Stanley Jones, you know, countless people. How should we be reacting? Should I be concerned if I'm more angry than usual, if I'm sadder than usual, if I feel disconnected? Is there a right or wrong way, generally speaking, not necessarily a habit of behaviors, but is there a right or wrong way that an individual could or should respond when these things happen to us?
Right. So for me, from my perspective, when I'm working with a client, I'm certainly saying to them that whatever reaction it is that you're having, that's a valid reaction. Let's start there. If you notice that you're feeling more angry, if you notice that you're feeling more pro-black, if you know that you are feeling more sleepy or you don't want to go to work, those are all signs or symptoms that we need to be sort of like focusing on, because in some way or other, those symptoms are going to lead us to, in my opinion, those are going to lead us to what's going to help you to get back to a place where you feel more healthy, right? So I often talk to folks about anger, and this is a really, I think, key component of working with racial trauma. Black people have every reason in this country to be angry all the time, all day, every day, because of the racism that has been perpetuated. What has happened, though, is that we all know what it means to be called an angry black man or to be called an angry black woman. That's a very distancing, pathologized way of seeing black people. So we try and distance ourselves away from the anger, right? But what I advocate for is you need to open up and embrace this anger, because that anger is an energy that is going to help you to heal. Anger actually gets people to move. Anger is creative. There is no social movement in the history of our country at which anger has not been the heart, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that anger has the capability and may be the only thing that is going to get us to move forward. So we have to get white clinicians as well as people of color clinicians to be okay with people being angry and letting whatever, even some of the other expressions that you were talking about, Jay, whatever the expression is, you've got to figure out how to nurture that experience. You can't just say to black people, well, you know, you're going to have to choose something other than anger, because that's just not going to do here in this professional setting. No, when you tell a person that, especially a person of color, you're in fact telling them that you don't want them to bring their whole self to whatever setting that they're coming into. And in fact, if you want the best out of that person, you want them to bring their whole self, including their anger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dr. Green, you co-authored a study regarding discrimination and oppressive symptoms among Black American men. Talk a bit about what you mean and what you all sought to identify as it relates to depression and self-esteem as it relates to discrimination. So maybe you're not like really, really traumatized, but you know, you kind of navigate life as a black man in the South or even in the North, perhaps. In what ways are our self-esteem, our sense of self-worth affected by just these microaggressions and these discriminations we face every day?
Yeah, that's also a great question, because I think that there is some gender socialization or racial gender socialization that plays out in how we experience racial trauma. When I sit with mostly men clients, what I see is so that there can be this avoidance of anger or this really hyper masculine way of trying to be in the world as a way of kind of coping with these other delicate or tender feelings that we don't want anybody to see. And what we know is that hypermasculinity or even toxic masculinity, while it may look like a person is strong, actually what we know is that that's probably a pretty weak, undefined person whose self-concept is not quite clarified the way that you would think that it is, right? People with positive self-worth, people with positive self-esteem know in some ways how to think in terms of, you know what, this situation is a racist situation, and that's about those white people over there and how they operate. This is not about me, right? But when you have a weaker self-esteem, you tend to internalize the racism. And what that will mean is that your self-worth will take a plunge. You will act in very toxic, reckless ways with other people. You may find yourself being isolated from other people. You just don't know how to manage your relationships well, right? And so if that is actually the case, you're not doing one of the important things, which is connecting with other people who are going to be able to mirror back to you that you're okay. And so as a result of having poor self-esteem or poor self-concept and isolating, we in some ways could just continue to languish in being traumatized and continue to get worse off.
So what are some of the therapies or recommendations that you have, Dr. Green, in studying racial trauma and working with clients who have suffered from racial trauma? What are some, you know, therapies that you could share with us that you kind of practice with your clientele and recommend to other clinicians who might have clientele who experience racial trauma?
Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking about it or thinking about it from a psychological perspective, I'll lay out these three things. I think that it becomes important, number one, behaviorally, for you to move your body, right? Mm-hmm. What we know is that this trauma is showing up in your body probably as stress. And when we are stressed and our cortisol levels at our higher rate, it makes it difficult for us to focus. It makes it difficult for us to sleep. Our appetite is affected. Our ability to be able to just, well, we have less energy. Getting out and moving your body helps to begin to help your body reset itself and to fight off the effects of the stress. The other piece that I would say is, and I was talking about this a little bit earlier, cognitively or from a brain-based or a mind-based perspective, we have to learn how to externalize the problem and not internalize the problem. As people of color in this country, with the way that history has been written, we tend to come out on the short end of the stick or be blamed for everything, right? And so when racial trauma occurs, we tend to blame ourselves. We can become really confused about that. The goal for me always when I'm working with clients is to help them look at a system and say that system is sick, right? Yeah. Rather than saying that I'm a sick person. Being able to flip the script that way actually puts you back into connection with your true self so that you can figure out what are the resources that you have in order to be able to rescue yourself. The other thing that I think is also going into the emotional piece is about validating the anger, the way I talked about it earlier. We really have to move into a place where we can understand that this, I should be angry about this. Mm-hmm. There's no way that I should be able to look at this and allow somebody else with me in therapy to tell me that I shouldn't be angry about this. You are cutting me off at the life source if you're trying to take away my anger. Again, anger is energizing. It's creative. It's where you get your sense of being able to move and do something from. If you don't have it, again, you're just going to languish in the trauma and probably come worse off.
Yeah. Mm. And just a disclaimer to our listeners, this is not medical advice for you all, right? This is, you know, how they do their own TV. This is not medical advice, you know, but all that to say, like, can I call in sick to work tomorrow because of racial trauma? Is that, doctor, is that your recommendation that I have your permission to call in?
Listen, we've all seen the calling in black video, right? I think that when the videos begin to become even more popular, right? And let's be clear about something. It's not that these race-related incidents have increased in number. They've always been happening. We just have the cell phones and we get to see them a bit more, right? One of the things that we definitely recommend for people who are experiencing racial trauma is to figure out how to disconnect. And you want to disconnect from sources, from stimuli that would trigger these feelings in you. And if one of those triggers is your job, you might need to call in black.
All right.
I know that's right.
Okay, I'll take it. Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Green, for joining us today.
Sure.
This has been a really insightful conversation.
And just before you go, let our listeners know that you're in the D.C. area, Maryland area?
I am. I'm in the DMV area. I am a staff psychologist at the University of Maryland, but I also have a small private practice where I see mostly black clients here,
okay.
And many of them talk to me about their issues with race and racism in their professional lives.
So let folks know, no matter where you are in the U.S., especially or maybe you're overseas, but if you're here in the U.S., no matter what state you're in, how can we begin to find practitioners that specialize in racialized trauma or that are culturally competent? Is there a directory, or should we ask certain questions to be able to figure out if someone can attend to our needs?
Oh, those are also great questions. So I know that for me, one of the ways that I do this, of course, is within the network of other trained clinicians that I know who are capable of doing the work. But you could also go to Psychology Today and look there for therapists. You could also go to some. I think there is a mental health bank for people of color. There's a listing on Facebook. There are multiples of those. You're making me think I might need to put together a Facebook page about this.
There we go.
But there are also questions that you should be asking. And what I would suggest is that you Google how to interview a therapist.
Okay.
There are some really great articles out there about the types of questions that you should be asking. And what people of color already know is that if you ask a therapist about race and they stumble or they go silent or they get nice, that is probably not the person for you. You want somebody who's going to be able to validate for you that racism is a real thing and it affects you.
All right. Dr. Carlton Green, thank you so much. Please take care, okay?
Thank you all so much. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we got to talk about a lot of stuff in Hot Topics. We got Monique. We got Jay-Z and his mama. We have the local police department. So let's take a quick break. Let the folks know who they're listening to.
You're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
My third item is a VHS cassette.
This is a 1940 edition of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None.
This is a piece of coral. My third thing is a scar that I have on my neck.
Rag doll that I was given by my mother when I turned 7.
Five things. It's like show and tell for grown-ups. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and don't miss a thing.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
All right. So I mentioned we have quite a few things to talk about in Hot Topics. First up, and I guess we'll probably spend the least amount of time because you and Laura's face when I mentioned the story was like, ooh, no. But it's worth a mention. GLAAD, which is the national organization that works around media representation of LGBTQ folks. They always have an annual ceremony where they honor people in media and pop culture who are doing stuff around queer and trans issues. And so this year they are honoring rapper Jay-Z and his mother Gloria Carter.
Okay.
Y'all ask like for what? I guess for her being a lesbian. I don't know what the award is for, but it's noteworthy that so Jay-Z's mother is a lesbian, which
yes.
He mentioned, I guess, for the first time officially on his album 444. Is that how you say it?
It's yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I guess it's like, yeah.
Rap, but yeah, 444. The song was called Smile, and he mentions on that song that his mother's a lesbian. I'll read you all. I'm not going to rap it, but I'll read. Should I rap it?
No.
Just read it?
I feel like you should try and rap it.
No, I'll just read it. So he says in this particular song, quote, Mama had four kids, but she's a lesbian. Had to pretend so long that she's a thespian. Cried tears of joy when you fell in love. Don't matter to me if it's a him or her. That's really sweet, you know? Like,
yeah.
He basically saying that his mom is a lesbian and that she had to pretend for so long to, I guess, not be. And so he accepts her just as she is. And so his mom actually did an interview back in September of last year where she talked to a podcast about what it was like coming out to Jay-Z. And she says, quote, I just finally started telling Jay who I was. Besides your mother, this is the person that I am. This is the life that I live. So my son started actually tearing up. He's like, that had to be a horrible life, Ma. And I was like, my life was never horrible. I was never ashamed of me. And so I guess they've had a really good relationship in terms of his acceptance. I don't want to see you say that word. He'd been cool with her being gay, you
yeah.
know, as we all hope that our family members would be. And it is noteworthy that Jay-Z, back in 2012, did an interview with CNN where he expressed support of marriage equality. So he's been, you know, like
an
his wife, or they've
yeah.
been like on the peripheral of support for queer people. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think it's been many, many years since he ever rapped anything homophobic. So anyway, they're getting a GLAAD award. So congratulations.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, I mean, it's like I live that he did that too. And
but you feel like
you
it's
know,
just for the publicity effect.
I feel like it's about the fact that Jay-Z might be there to pick up the GLAAD Award.
Yeah.
He'll for sure be there.
Yeah,
I mean, hopefully, because we know that Bay doesn't necessarily show up for her award.
Yeah, she doesn't, but I think for the most part, all celebrities who get honored by GLAAD, like, they almost always show up. Like, I feel like the GLAAD talks them in advance of to be sure they're actually going to be there. Like, I've never heard of GLAAD honor somebody who doesn't show up. So, I'm with you that if you feel like it's like, ooh. You know, they always always honor somebody this high profile, like, to kind of, like, the excitement and all that
stuff. So we live. I mean, I just
congratulations.
Okay, yeah.
For getting an award for having a gay mama. Doc, there's another case I want to talk to you about. I don't know if you saw it. I posted on Facebook today. LMPD, the Louisville Metro Police Department. Okay. They've been in the news for a lot of stuff lately. Most recently, there's this whole investigation regarding this thing called the Explorer Program. The Explorer Program is a now defunct program, I believe, but it basically was like a sort of like an Eagle Scout program, right? It was for young people who might want to be police officers. It's sort of like a mentoring program where they get to go and perhaps direct traffic or help with kind of like non-police duties, but in an official capacity. And it's like a mentoring program. They get to interact with police officers. And so several years ago, it's been alleged that there were two officers in particular that were having sexual relations with underage young people, both boys and girls. And there was, you know, so then there was alleged there was a cover-up because some of the parents turned over text messages.
So was it relations or was it rape?
Okay. I mean, I was trying to, like, keep it real. Okay, they were sexually raped. They were raping and sexually assaulting these young people.
Yes. Okay.
And so one of the young people's parents reported it. But there were some allegations that it was a cover-up and it wasn't passed up the chain. And so now there's this really major lawsuit, and they're subpoenaing the mayor and the police chief and trying to get to the bottom of who, you know, where did the buck stop? Who knew and who covered things up? Yada, yada, yada. So anyway, that's one reason LMPD's been in the headlines. They're in the headlines today because they were recently granted $1.2 million. This is in fall of 16. They were granted $1.2 million, you know, because there's always this thing of we need more money for policing. We need more money for policing. We need, you know, more cops on the streets and yada, yada, yada. And so they were granted $1.2 million to help support that. $600,000 of that money was gone within 6 weeks. So, like, $1.2 million is for, like, an entire year.
Right.
Half of that money is gone in 6 weeks, and it's used on overtime by a handful of officers.
Oh, wow.
There are a handful of officers, Doc, who are saying that they worked 21-hour days. Okay?
Okay.
How many hours in a day? 24, right? Still 24, right?
Yes.
They work 21-hour days. And not just, you know, maybe one day a week you do. Okay, whatever. You got to put a double shift. I've been there. They work 21-hour days every day of the week.
Oh, wow.
For months at a time. Okay, so let's start with 21-hour days. And again, this ain't all cops, whatever, whatever. But that's a significant number to the tune of $600,000 in 6 weeks of overtime. They filed timesheets and said they worked 21-hour days, 7 days a week, 4 weeks a month, several months out the year.
And now
the deputy mayor, the city officials are saying that they're reviewing, quote unquote, reviewing the situation. Now, I don't know what needs to be reviewed. If you own your job, Doc, if you work in a factory or you work at McDonald's, you work anywhere.
Yeah.
You turn on a timesheet that says you work 21 hours at your job.
Yeah.
Every day.
And you also aren't suffering from sleep deprivation.
Doc, that's a whole other thing.
Fatigue. You haven't gotten, immune system isn't run down. You haven't gotten sick or a cold or
the
flu. You
got 4 hours. You get four. Yeah. Like, you don't even get 4 hours of sleep because you still got to drive home.
Yeah, basically.
Get into bed.
Yes.
Get up, take a shower, brush your teeth. Mm-hmm, so you probably got 2.5 hours of sleep.
Very much so.
For months at a time, you get 2.5 hours a day. And even if that were true, even if you were not inflating your timesheets, who can function successfully on any job?
That's what I mean. Yeah.
On 2 hours of sleep a day.
Yeah.
Let alone a high impact, high stress job
like
with
that.
A handgun and a taser and people's lives at stake. You can function. You can do that.
Yeah.
Off 2 hours of sleep.
And they say,
literally,
every day for months. I mean, studies have proven that it's worse to be sleep deprived when driving than it is to be drunk. So I don't know.
They don't let truck drivers drive that many hours without taking a nap.
Yeah. So
you know,
I'm
and
just,
so for me, like, okay, you know, and unfortunately, what it does, you know, is a few bad cops, you know, have now brought more ill regard to the department, you know, and for me, what pisses me off even more, Doc, is not just that it happened, but that you have city officials like the deputy mayor, and I want to read her name. She's the chief of staff of deputy mayor. Her name is Ellen Hessen. She is testifying that they are concerned, quote unquote, concerned about overtime, and they're reviewing it. No, people need to be fired immediately.
Yeah,
you need to release the names of all these officers, because my thing is, if I'm an attorney, if my client interacted with you on one of your 21-hour shifts.
Very true.
I need them cases dismissed, boo.
Mm-hmm.
Because you was out of sound mind. You was delusional.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see what you thought you saw because I can't stay up 12 mm-hmm. hours without mm-hmm. a nap, you know?
No, it certainly has bigger implications and ramifications than inflating the time she's in and of itself. I mean, it has everything to do with who, what kind of paperwork they filled out during this time, what kind of arrest,
approved this? I mean, just to me, it's just so absurd, Doc. Just to me,
and the supervisors who are approving these times week after week and not noticing that they were inflated whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, and to me, like the things that these people are being accused of doing, Doc, everyday citizens like you and I would be fired and or arrested immediately.
Yeah, no, very
sexual
true.
Abuse, mm-hmm. fraud, stealing from your job, falsifying time sheets, lying under oath. We would be under the jail.
I know.
So why is it that these folk, right, who are expected to exhibit a higher caliber of behavior, right, you know, they're supposed to be held to a higher standard, why is it that cops oftentimes get more leeway, right, get more benefit mm-hmm. of the doubt than everyday citizens? Why is it that when, you know, we see it happen, of course, the shootings, but even when it comes to things like improper behavior or conduct unbecoming, they seem to get, you know, more leeway than anybody else would get in the same situation. So I just thought that was just a really absurd mm-hmm. story that I wanted to share with you and share with our listeners, just how ridiculous that you all can spend over $500,000 in 6 weeks in overtime among a handful of officers. And then nobody said, how is it that you work in a 21-hour day and you're doing it every day of the week and you're doing it for several weeks at a time?
Yeah, and no, there's no questioning and there's no, it's absolutely absurd.
Anyway, the last story, Doc, which I'll let you take the lead on, of course, is Monique. We want to talk a bit about Monique. And it's a story that's been making headlines everywhere.
Yes. I mean, so Monique recently, I feel like it was last week sometime, at the end of last week, actually, where she released a video discussing how she was not giving the proper, you know, pay amount from Netflix, saying that everyone needs to protest Netflix and boycott Netflix because of sexism and racism. You know, she's a black woman comic. She argued in the video that she's one of the most decorated comics still living, the most significant comics still living, and that they offered and lowballed her when it came to
a comedy special.
They offered Amy Schumer much more, Dave Chappelle a considerable amount, much more than both of them. And so, you have Wanda Sykes, who's also joined.
So Monique says that she was offered $500,000.
Yeah, $500,000.
To do a Netflix special. Mm-hmm. She says that Amy Schumer received something like $11,000, and Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock both got
$11,000.
I'm sorry. Thank you. $11 million.
Okay, yeah.
$11,000.
Okay,
that's how much you and I would get for our comedy.
Okay,
But probably a little bit more than that. But
like $100.
No, I would, girl. Probably at least $1,000, you think?
First of all, Netflix would not be calling us.
We wouldn't do Netflix. We would do, obviously, YouTube. I mean, I feel like that's a better platform. Like, public TV. Public access channel on cable.
Okay.
But nonetheless, that Amy Schumer got $11 million. Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock got something like $20 million. Mm-hmm. And so Monique's contention is that she is highly decorated. As she considers herself, she claims, the most decorated comedian. And we'll come back. Talk more about that fact, right? But she feels like black people in particular should boycott Netflix because they only offered her $500,000 and these other people got so much more money. There's mm-hmm. a whole lot I want to talk about. I just want to run over a few. And Funky Don Eva, did you see Funky Don Eva's video? Funky Don Eva's that comedian out of Atlanta, and he made some really, really brilliant points, which I would summarize. And that is, number one, about negotiations, right? And so mm-hmm. if they come in at $500,000, but Monique comes in at $11 or $12 million. Well, it's very likely that Netflix came in ready to negotiate, right? And anything you could offer a low number, probably a job.
Right.
You know, they're like, I'll offer you this. You say, well, I want this, right? And you negotiate, right? And then there's some kind of meeting in the middle. And they probably were authorized to give her up to maybe like, what, $3 million, right? But that Monique's contention that she deserved $20 million was so disproportionate to the first
offer.
It's like a 98% difference between
what they offered.
Yeah, that they were like, there's no point in wasting time. They told her, like, there's no point in wasting our time or your time. There's such a difference in what we're prepared to offer you and what you're demanding. There's no need to even negotiate.
Yeah.
Now, again, Monique is saying, $500,000, no, give me $7 million. And they said, well, we'll give you $3 million. And then, you know, like that's how, but for you to insist that you deserve 98% more than what they're prepared to offer. So there was that issue going on. For me, there's the issue of relevance, you know, and let's keep it real. Monique is contending that she's so decorated, she's a legend. Those things may be true, but as Don Eva said, Aretha Franklin's a legend, right? But her last album went to Walmart, you know, like just because one, you know, but you get what I'm saying?
Oh,
just because one has a body of work, you know.
Plus, I would argue that Monique is not and hasn't been in recent years. I'd say in the past 10 years or so, been doing stand-up comedy.
No,
I mean, she's moved from stand-up comedy
to sitcoms
and to film.
Yeah.
And a lot of the visibility around Monique has a lot to do with the Oscar for Precious and a lot
and
to
I
do
think
with
that she
her
was
work
reliant on that Oscar thing. That was going to be her cash cow.
But
I think if Passes Prelude, we see an Oscar in and of itself doesn't make anybody a celebrity.
Very true.
Nor does it translate an Oscar for a dramatic role translate to a comedy special that warrants $20 million.
Yeah, I mean, and again, like, you know, you have Tracee Ellis Ross, for instance, who's, kind of arguing the same thing about the differentiation around Black-ish and stuff like that. And so that's what I was wanting to talk about with you.
Yeah.
It seems as if folks were very clear when Tracee Ellis Ross says, hey, I'm not getting paid as much as Anthony Anderson for Black-ish, and that's a problem, and I'm basically going to limit my visibility on the show if that doesn't change, right?
Yes.
Everyone seemed to be sharing that post and talking about that post and this and the third, and so, but when it came to Monique saying, well, hey, I'm not getting paid what I'm owed, which is a similar argument to Tracee Ellis, why do you think that there's been such a differentiation between folks supporting Tracee Ellis Ross and not Monique?
I think there's a number of differences. Number one, I think that there's a number of differences. Number one, Tracee Ellis Ross is already on that show. So she's talking about getting paid equally for work that she's already performing, right?
Yes, that she's already done.
She's demonstrated a bit. And if you ask me, she's the one who makes the show. She and the kids. Anthony Anderson,
I completely agree.
But she's demonstrated over the course of these 4 or 5 years, so that's something that she's already. And she also wasn't telling people boycott Black-ish, right? What she's saying is, I'm not getting paid what I feel like I deserve, so what I want you all to do is to modify my contract so that I can work less hours.
Mm-hmm.
She's not telling people, go boycott, Black-ish, because you can't make someone do with their money what they don't want to do with their money.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can do is control your own time. So she says, I will limit my, so I think that was a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Monique kind of saying, well, because I didn't get my way, I want y'all to boycott Netflix. And that also doesn't account for the fact that Netflix puts a lot of people of color to work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no shade. Orange is the New Black, right? What we know Laverne Cox from, most people know her from in pop culture, came from Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
They put a Black trans woman to work, right?
Yes.
A lot of their original programming has people of color and queer folks.
Extremely diverse.
And so I think it's a little bit unfair to say, blinkingly, boycott this network because they didn't give me what I want.
And I've also noticed that people, while they support Monique because they do believe that the film industry and as progressive as Netflix is, that it still probably has its issues when it comes to negotiations, when it comes to race, gender, stuff like that, that they support Monique in her crusade for getting paid what she's owed or what she feels that she's owed. But they also aren't going to boycott Netflix. So I've seen that.
And it's also in her approach, Doc, as well. Like, her approach. Mm. I think that, Wanda Sykes pointed out, because Wanda Sykes said, they offered me $250,000. They offered me even less than you.
Mm.
But Wanda Sykes said, what I did is I went and I found another network to give me what I felt like I was owed. And so I think that there's something, and again, I'm not here for policing somebody's reaction. But my thing is, at the end of the day, you can't make somebody do with their money what you don't want them to do. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that people don't necessarily appreciate the way in which she went about it by blowing up the spot, And people see her as unreasonable when she begins making claims like, I'm more decorated than anybody else. I'm the female Richard Pryor. And so just for the record, I did want to, I'm looking for the stats now about how many awards Monique has gotten and compared to other people.
Yeah, because I've been seeing many memes talking about she's gotten over 57
awards.
She has
three more awards than Whoopi Goldberg. So they list like the number of awards and the number of nominations without awards. So technically she has more awards. She has three more awards than Whoopi Goldberg.
Okay.
Right? Whoopi has far more nominations. Whoopi, of course, has a Grammy, an Oscar.
And these awards are for comedy?
So these awards aren't necessarily for comedy. These awards are for primarily for her role as an actress in Precious.
Oh.
So that's what she's saying. She says, I'm the most decorated comedian, which is again true. Comedian slash actress, but you're not necessarily decorated for comedy awards. You know what I'm saying? She's saying that because I have more awards than anybody else. So again, to me, they're false equivalencies. They don't make sense.
Mm-hmm,
you want to be given a bunch of money for a comedy special on the strength of your awards for an acting, it just doesn't make sense.
I think that you made a point earlier last week when we were talking about this initially, just over the phone, keying about it, and saying that, Monique hasn't necessarily been this advocate for any certain any any kind of cause, you know, doesn't necessarily and hasn't necessarily used her platform to forward the agenda of LGBT rights necessarily, right? Where she might show up at Pride, and she's never said anything homophobic in her comedy, certainly. But
she has. She's made fun of gay, you know. But she's been somebody who's been there for gay people, you know, but never publicly.
Right. Unlike someone like Kerry Washington, right? Or someone like even Tracee Ellis Ross, who, you know, participates in programs like Black Girls Rock and, you know, trying to get folks involved and engaged in some type of citizenry, if you will, like in advocacy. And so she doesn't necessarily show up in those spaces, but
do we see her for BLM stuff, right?
Yeah,
as women's marches, like
right.
So where has she shown up for other people? I think that's also me too. Where she
showed up for other people around these same lines that she's arguing around race and gender, right? And so for me, as someone who really isn't a fan of stand-up comedy, period, like you ain't going to catch me sitting around
no comedy club
watching, you know, no, definitely. I mean, not no Laugh Factory, nothing. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go be sitting around watching no stand-up, no way, you know?
Yeah.
And even when it comes to movies that are about comedy, that's really not my forte,
it's not your forte
either.
Yeah.
And
we like old
you know,
drama.
When it comes to black women comics, Samora has always been a favorite of mine.
Oh yeah.
Versus someone like Monique, who to me, when she gets her start is about poking fun at her size,
self-deprecating,
and the
skinny
fact
bitches, and all this other stuff.
You know,
yeah.
So to me, I never thought it was funny.
All that funny?
No, not because of one. I'm a big black woman, so I never thought that her talking about being big and black and how that was this, you know, in this deprecation of such was something that, you know, and I know that a lot of folks took that comedy as, oh, you know, she's funny, she's keeping it real. And I just felt like it was, you know, no. I mean, I see it as the same as Melissa McCarthy. Some of Melissa McCarthy's comedy I find funny, but I tire of seeing her putting herself in a position where she's the butt of a joke.
Or Rebel Wilson, even.
I mean,
like, it's all
Monique
about the
had
physical
a whole
kind
TV
of, yeah,
show
yeah.
about how she was couldn't be the object of affection because she was an overweight black woman. So I just, you know, which is, again, the Parkers,
certainly,
where she's kind of lusting for the professor. And the only reason why we laugh is because it's absurd for her big tail to be lusting after this professor. So for me, I've never found anything that she's ever done. I didn't watch Precious whatsoever because I'd rather read the book Push.
I liked it. It was good.
Right?
Though,
so again, I didn't watch Precious. Yeah. I'm not, you know, again, I read Push by Sapphire, you know, but them changing the character in Precious to Paula Patton, this light, straight-haired woman, as opposed to the dark-skinned black woman she was in the novel. So, again, most of her work, I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
While I completely support and advocate for justice and equal treatment when it comes to especially coins and money and getting paid what you are owed, and I do believe that industries such as film and television are notorious for exploiting black women, this is just something I'm like, girl.
And it's unfair.
And so
it's unfair to characterize all of us who don't cape for Monique as somehow not being here for black women.
I agree.
Like, I think that's a really simple and a really kind of like.
Yeah. And it's another false equivalence.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So somehow, oh, I see y'all plantation folks. Yeah. Y'all not supporting Monique, so y'all are lost.
Y'all was here for Colin Kaepernick, but y'all ain't here. And it's like, that's not the same.
Or folks who are trying to pit the black women who are advocating for themselves against one another. So, y'all bigging up Tracee Ellis Ross because she light skinned and thin with curly hair, but y'all ain't going to say nothing about Monique because she's heavy and she's brown skinned. And it's like, yo, that has nothing to do with it. Like, you know, half of the folks who I see caping for didn't even share, didn't go to see Precious, didn't watch the Parkers, didn't watch Monique stand up, don't think she's all that when it comes to comedy, and prefer people like Samora, no shade. So, no. I mean, I just, that's why I haven't even touched it. I advocate, and I think that you advocate as well, for justice and people getting paid what they are owed.
Yeah.
And I do believe that one's self-esteem and self-worth should not be measured by outside entities like a film industry that is racist and sexist. So
the professor
just said
that. Yeah, he just said about the notion of your self-esteem being validated by the way someone treats you.
So I am glad that Monique feels the way she does about herself. I am glad that she feels empowered enough to advocate for herself. But I just, you know, I don't need to do boycott Netflix for her. And I just, you know, because I'm like, until she comes up with a different type of shtick, until she comes up with a different type of comedy that isn't somehow at my expense as a big black woman, because I am desirable, I am sexy. So while she thinks she's the most decorated comic, I don't think I'm a butt of a joke. Oh. And it's no shade.
Well, there we go. There you have it, folks. There you have
okay.
it. Right on.
So it's no shade.
No shade on that. Doc, before we go, we want to give a special shout out to one of our listeners, DeAndre. He's a student of yours.
Oh, yes.
You want to share the story he shared with you, or should we say he's a big fan of our show?
Yes, that you know, DeAndre is a big fan of the show, and he's currently in my Black Lesbian Lives class this semester. And every time I speak with him and talk to him, he is always, you
so
know,
nice,
talking about
yeah.
the show and affirming what we do here.
Yeah,
and talking about being, you know, a young person of color growing up in a kind of more isolated community,
yeah.
and how the show has moved him and touched
been important
him,
to him. Yeah.
And in so many ways, and how it's made him feel very empowered and liberated. And so it's just so good to hear
those
things.
People let us know those things. Yeah,
and it means the world to us. And so we wanted to give you a special shout out.
Yes, shout
Thanks
out to you,
for
DeAndre.
Listening
yes,
and supporting that,
that's
the show.
My homie. Yes, thank you.
And always showing us love, honey.
Yeah, so thank you to DeAndre, but thank you to all of you, dear listeners. You all, our listeners have been going up, Doc. Like, we
yes.
have, with, you know, every week our listeners go up and people provide us feedback. We had our friend who gave us feedback on the last show on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And so we always appreciate when you all let us know via Facebook or via Twitter or any other kind of social media what you think of the show. So as always, thank y'all for listening. We will be back next week. Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our producer is Laura Ellis.
For more information, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at strangefruitpod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of LPM, its staff, or its underwriters.
Our executive producers are me, Jason Gardner,
and me, Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.